This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Monday, December 30th. Today's New York Times has the most detailed accounting that I've seen of the 84 days during which the military aid to Ukraine was withheld. The article reveals a previously undisclosed meeting in late August at which Secretary of State Pompeo, Defense Secretary Mike Esper, and National Security Advisor John Bolton all tried to convince President Trump that releasing the aid was in the interest of the United States, but Trump wouldn't budge. The article also discloses for the first time that they were considering a legal rationale that would say even though Congress passed a law mandating that the military aid be given, Trump could invoke his power as commander-in-chief to unilaterally overrule it. And the article offers more clarity on the central involvement of Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and Office of Management and Budget official Michael Duffy. Remember, the Democrats are pushing for Mulvaney and Duffy, who's not as well known, and John Bolton to testify at the trial of Donald Trump when that begins in the Senate. But will those witnesses appear? You know there's a big partisan tug of war on that. You know Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that despite being the lead juror in the case as Senate Majority Leader, he's coordinating with the White House defense team. But did you know that on Christmas Eve, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska became the first Republican to question the legitimacy of McConnell on that?
And in fairness, when I heard that, I was disturbed.
Disturbed by what exactly, Senator?
To me, it means that we have to take that step back from being hand in glove with the defense. And so I heard what Leader McConnell had said. I happen to think that that has further confused the process.
So will the story that the Times today describes in such detail be told by the witnesses at trial, or will politics stand in the way of the evidence being presented to even judge the president on? We'll talk about the tug of war over that question now, plus some other developments like Secretary of State Pompeo suddenly announcing a meeting for later this week with Ukraine's President Zelensky, and President Trump retweeting a name that's being alleged to be the CIA whistleblower who brought the whole scandal to light. Maybe that's impeachable, considering the whistleblower law that's supposed to protect people like that from retaliation. With me now, Associated Press White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, who gets the Keep Calm and Carry On Award today for even being here. He guest hosted Morning Joe on MSNBC today from 6 to 9 a.m. And here he is, all bright and cheery, on time, no less, nonetheless. Thanks so much, Jonathan. Thanks for coming on again.
It's my pleasure, and because it's radio, people can't see the huge cup of coffee I currently have.
Can we start with the whistleblower thing? Because it's so outrageous, and I was serious about my question about that being at least potentially impeachable. What did the president do exactly?
So the president has been inching toward this for a while. He has, for several months now, really tried to make the whistleblower and the identity of this person, one that we, of course, we're not going to say here, central to the case against him, sort of ignoring the idea that the allegations by the whistleblower have been corroborated pretty much exclusively up and down by both witnesses, documents, even some of that rough memo slash transcript that the White House put out of the president's call with President Zelensky from over the summer. But they feel like this is part of what has been an overarching White House strategy here to sort of blame the, quote, deep state, if you will, that there's a conspiracy against him. And what has happened in recent weeks is the president has talked about the whistleblower, demanded the whistleblower testify, suggested the whistleblower had an agenda to get him, was a political operative, things of that sort. And there's nothing, he's not provided any evidence to corroborate any of that. Some of his allies, including his eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., have indeed named this person, the alleged whistleblower. The president himself
I saw it in a New York Post column the other day,
Right out there, right. The president himself had not done so until the other night, where he retweeted, I believe twice, articles that mentioned or tweets that mentioned, one was a tweet, one was an article that mentioned this person's name. That there was a little confusion because overnight, at least one of them disappeared from Twitter. One of his retweets did, and there was a suspicion that, perhaps the president had second thoughts. Someone got to him and said, look, sir, you should take this down. That's not the case. Twitter later explained that it was some sort of glitch. The tweet is now back up on his account. And, of course, it must be mentioned here. This is This is dangerous. This is a person, the whistleblower, who is reportedly receiving armed escort to and from work. This is someone who I think a lot of Democrats have said, you know, this is someone whose life potentially could be in jeopardy here if, you know, the wrong person were to get the wrong idea. And the president, with his 68 million or so Twitter followers, you know, shining a light on this person's identity worries a lot of people.
My understanding of the whistleblower law is that it does not mandate identity protection per se, but it does ban workplace retaliation for someone blowing the whistle on bad behavior by one of their bosses. What's your understanding of the law?
The same. I think that right now, from my reading of it, and that the president himself has not necessarily violated the law just yet, but it's inviting perhaps people to do so. And I think that's a great concern. And of course, there are a number of Republicans, Senator Rand Paul perhaps chief among them, who for a long time was a real champion of strengthening whistleblower laws. But yet in this case, Paul and others in his party have sort of really gone the other way and suggested this whistleblower of wrongdoing.
Isn't Trump's retweet of the possible identity retaliation on its face? It seems uncomplicated to me. I mean, Trump is simply trying to punish this person by making him or her a target of the right for pointing out the questionable phone call with Trump and Zelensky or the larger pressure campaign. Is there any other plausible explanation for why Trump would push the identity forward other than to retaliate?
It seems unlikely, or at the very least, if not to full out retaliate, but at least to spotlight. I think White House lawyers will disagree and say the president was simply, you know, retweeting an article. And you know, we've heard him use that excuse before, both during the campaign and since he's taken office, where he has retweeted things that were inflammatory or racist or just very hateful. And he has been very dismissive of that, saying, well, I didn't say that myself. It was just a retweet.
Yeah. And this may be beyond your beat as a White House correspondent, but if any supervisor of the employee in any agency other than the President of the United States did that to a whistleblower against them, what would the consequences likely be?
You're right. It's not my purview, but I suspect there would be some that, you know, this person would probably be, you know, subject to some disciplinary action at work and perhaps even dismissal. Of course, that's not going to happen with the president of the United States, who can sort of at this moment feel like he can tweet with impunity.
Yeah. This does play into the battle over witnesses, too. The Republicans have wanted to call the whistleblower to testify, even though the whistleblower just passed along information that the person was told and the White House is trying to withhold the actual people most centrally involved at the same time. How does the White House square that contradiction?
Well, the White House, let's be clear. I mean, their defense is they're playing, this is a political argument. They are suggesting this is that the whistleblower had some sort of agenda against the president, and they're trying to turn it into a circus. They want, you know, we have a difference of opinion here among the White House and President Trump sort of has suggested that he'd like the impeachment trial to be sort of this showy event that could last several weeks where several witnesses, including Hunter Biden, the vice president's former vice president's son, would appear because in his mind, and again, this is just simply what he has said, that he feels like it would completely exonerate him, that the American public would go along. They'd be hooked by the drama of the trial. And by the end of it, he would be exonerated because certainly we do anticipate that the Republican-controlled Senate will not vote to remove him from office. However, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who has much more of a say, actually, than the president in this, has suggested that that's not what he wants, that he wants something short. He wants to get it over with in a week or two. It's going to be pretty perfunctory. He's not looking to call witnesses. And there are some Republican allies, Senator Lindsey Graham among them, who have sort of warned the president off of this, who have tried to say to him, like, look, we've already told you what the verdict's going to be here. You're going to be acquitted. Let us just get there. Don't gum up the works with these witnesses, particularly because if there is some sort of deal to bring the whistleblower or Hunter Biden to testify, the Democrats are going to demand some too. And that could be John Bolton or Secretary of State Pompeo or others who would potentially be damaging to the president.
We always have to remember in this context that this is still a political context and not a court of law. Here is Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana on CNN State of the Union yesterday.
The Senate is not really a jury. It's both jury and judge. The Chief Justice is not the judge. He's the presiding officer. There are no standards of proof. There are no rules of evidence. And every senator, unless we pass a new rule by 51 votes in the Senate, is entitled to approach it his own way.
There are no standards of proof. There are no rules of evidence. Now, on its face, that might sound like when Rudy Giuliani said, truth isn't truth,
right,
or Kellyanne Conway said, you have facts, but I have alternative facts. infuriating maybe to one side or another. But in this case, he's not actually wrong, is he?
No, this is not a court of law. This is a political process. The founders intended this as such. This is not the courtroom, you know, on Center Street in Manhattan. This is a different animal altogether.
Right. So when he says no standards of proof, that means there's no sort of preponderance of evidence versus reasonable doubt or other things like that that juries or grand juries are instructed to take into account in order to indict or convict.
Correct. And we have jurors in this case, senators, Republican senators, who have already said, before this trial begins, they've already reached their verdict. They already know what their decision is going to be. And I think that does frustrate some. And look, everything here needs to be viewed through a political lens. There are some who feel like the Democrats, that they worry that they have going to hand President Trump, you know, if he survives this trial, if he's acquitted, you know, he has talked about even launching a quote not guilty tour, if you will, in terms of barnstorming the country and saying that, look, the Democrats came at me with their best shot and I survived it. His staff believes that will really rally his base and perhaps even swing over some independents to his side. But Democrats go the other way and say, I think, with good reason, to say, look, we have an obligation to the rule of law, we have an obligation to the Constitution to do this, even if we do think that the outcome in the Senate is sort of foretold. First of all, they do hold out hope that some Republican senators will go into this with an open mind, and I think we'd all like to believe that at least some will. But even if that were not the case, even if we know the outcome in advance, this is still a step they feel like they had to take. And the report from the Times over the weekend, which was really terrific and very thorough and well done, sort of indicates why House Speaker Pelosi felt like her hand was forced, that the president and his staff did these things, and therefore they had to go down the road to impeachment.
Yeah, and the other piece of that Kennedy quote, there are no standards of proof, there are no rules of evidence. No rules of evidence is relevant to this tug of war over witnesses because presumably, from what I understand about rules of evidence in a formal legal context, Hunter Biden would not be callable. Joe Biden would not be callable. The whistleblower probably would not be callable because they're not relevant to the alleged crime of whether the president abused his power by trying to get a foreign government involved in our domestic political campaign or by withholding aid to extort that.
Right. And they'd be tangential at best, I think. And that's the point that the former vice president tried to make over the weekend, somewhat in a clumsy fashion, where he suggested that, his first response was that he wouldn't comply with the subpoena. And he sort of walked that back and later said that, of course, he respects the subpoena, he respects the process and so on, but said that he did not feel that he and his son were relevant to this, that they're not the ones standing trial or they're not the ones being impeached. The president is.
Yeah. And politically, just to close this loop, if the Republican majority, which presumably would have the power to do so, were to try to call Joe Biden or Hunter Biden or the whistleblower or Adam Schiff, then the Democrats could make such a big political show of, well, then why aren't you calling the actual fact witnesses, Mulvaney and Bolton and Michael Duffy, that the Democrats could potentially win the public argument on that, and then they'd have to call them. And so I presume that's what Mitch McConnell is trying to avoid.
Yes, exactly. And McConnell and Graham and others in the Senate, again, are sort of telling the president, like, despite your inclination for this showy trial that you feel like will exonerate you, that's not the right thing to do here. There is a risk that we could lose the political argument, we could lose the image battle, lose public opinion. Why risk that for a verdict you already know what's going to be?
This detailed New York Times account today of the 84 days when the military aid was withheld, it had that previously undisclosed late August meeting where Bolton, Pompeo, and Secretary of Defense Mike Esper tried to convince Trump to release the aid as being in the U.S. national interest. What light does that shed on the bigger context, including how much Trump was directing the pressure campaign himself to cook up an investigation of the Bidens in 2016?
There seem to be a few new developments here. First, yes, the president himself was more personally involved than I think people perhaps realized in terms of ordering the aid withheld to force these investigations. It shows you that there was some concern among his top advisors. You mentioned Esper, Bolton, Pompeo, who showed concern, who fought against this, believing that the U.S. financial military aid to Ukraine was vital for national interest, for national security, and it should not be withheld. There's that really good moment in the story about Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, sort of stepping in and out of the office, allowing the president to speak to Rudy Giuliani in private to preserve attorney-client privilege, which again sort of would seem to indicate that sort of knew something was up and that therefore this was not perhaps all above board. And also it should be pointed out that the president had executive branch lawyers working on a theory that he could override congressional funding decisions simply because he was president, which of course is not the case. It really throws the whole system of checks and balances out of whack.
One thread in the Times article is about how there may have been two separate things going on at the same time that only merged eventually. The Trump and Giuliani campaign for the investigations that Mulvaney stepped out of the room so he wouldn't know about, and withholding of the aid for other reasons, a more general distrust and disdain for Ukraine and even a foreign aid generally by Trump. How clear is it to you at this point how much two separate things were going on, or if they only came together later in this process?
Some of that we're still obviously discovering. I mean, the president has been leery of delivering foreign aid, period. You know, we hear him time and time again rail against other countries, NATO members in particular, for not doing enough, he believes, in terms of just to guarantee their own security. Ukraine's among them. We also know the president has always had a very skeptical view of Ukraine, believing that falsely, believing that Ukraine was working against him during the 2016 elections, believing the whole CrowdStrike DNC server theory, which of course has been disproven. And, you know, it has been alleged, has parroted talking points from Russian President Vladimir Putin, who of course has his own agenda with Ukraine. And there has been reporting that Putin put some of these ideas in the president's head early in his term, and that the president soured on Ukraine all along. And then there may have been this confluence of events when you include the Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's presence there.
Secretary of State Pompeo will meet with President Zelensky this week.
Yes, the State Department just announced that this morning. Some of the details are still being worked out, but that is now on the books, which will be certainly a closely watched meeting just a few days or perhaps a week or two before the impeachment trial, we believe, will set to begin once Speaker Pelosi transmits the articles.
In a trial with no rules, is that a pretrial motion to say, see, we gave them meetings?
Perhaps so. If it's about public opinion, that could be sort of the case they're trying to make.
So what happens next? What's the timeline once the House and Senate come back next week?
Well, yes, right now everyone is still out. The president is on his vacation in Mar-a-Lago, where he is slated to be until Sunday. And that, you know, there is not quite clarity yet as to what the timetable will be, because Speaker Pelosi has said that she won't transmit the articles until she receives some sort of guarantees that this will be a fair trial. There's, you know, that whole process stalled, perhaps understandably, over the Christmas week. I think there'll probably be some discussions again this week. But I think there might not be a lot of movement until the following week, until we clear New Year's, until the week of Monday the 6th, I believe it is. And we may not see the trial start for another week or two after that. And perhaps even later, if this really does bog down, which may push the trial, interestingly enough, into February, when, of course, we have votes being cast in Iowa and New Hampshire. The president is slated to give his State of the Union address the first week of February. So we have a really busy and interesting couple of weeks ahead.
And a very uncertain couple of weeks ahead, more uncertain than people probably thought it was going to be in terms of timing after the House made sure to impeach before Christmas. All right, after hosting 3 hours of Morning Joe and then coming on with us, I'd say it's Jonathan Lemire nap time.
Yes.
But you have a little kid at home, don't you?
Two of them, 8 and 5. Won't be a nap.
Who gets the first nap?
it'll be dad.
It better be. Sweet dreams if you can, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org.